Welcome to the Green to Gold podcast that informs our listeners on how the growing low-carbon building mandates and liabilities can be turned into profitable business opportunities. I'm your host, Robert Politzer, and each week we embark on a journey to explore innovative solutions and strategies that aim to make building upgrades and decarbonization profitable while addressing typical client building owner objections and concerns. Today, I want to welcome Brad Molotsky, a seasoned, pragmatic, senior business and legal counselor with the Duane Morris Law Firm. Brad's practice area of focus is on acquisition, opportunity zone fund creation and opportunity zone development, sale and joint ventures of commercial real estate, leasing, public-private partnerships, and board governance matters, including corporate social responsibility. Brad's very community-oriented, having served on numerous charitable, civil, and trade association boards, is a spouse and parent, and is interested in giving back environmental, social, governance, special needs issues, energy efficiency, and sustainability. Brad, it is a true pleasure to have you on with us for this podcast today.
Rob, the pleasure is mine. It's almost, it sounds like you're describing somebody else, but it's very kind of you.
Yes, it happens to be you, my friend. And
my God.
Yeah. So, Brad, you have this, what I find to be a somewhat unusual combination of professional specialties in both commercial real estate law and in green buildings. How is it that you arrived at this point in your professional career where those two components came together?
How much time do we have on the podcast? That's a longer conversation as to how I got involved, which is, again, we could talk about that on a different day. But suffice it to say, when I was, prior to being at Duane Morris, I was at Brandywine Realty Trust for a long time, about 18 years. And during that time period, the company was buying land, building buildings, buying companies, doing joint ventures, you know, typical stuff for an office and residential REIT, good guys doing good stuff. Along that journey, people started to think about, probably 2008-09, what are we doing for our customers, our tenants, and how are we buying stuff, and what does that look like in the 30-ish million square feet of space that we owned and joint ventured? You know, could we buy paint, ceiling tile, carpet, wallboard that was more sustainable, less off-gassing? Mm-hmm. Could we always kind of built buildings that were energy efficient, but could we pay attention a little bit more to lights, controls, and give the tenants something that they could use in their own spaces to reduce consumption? Mm-hmm. And so it started a little bit of, you know, Mr. Toad's wild ride on, well, once we started pulling at a couple of pieces, there were a lot of pieces to pull at. So energy, water, waste, you know, mm-hmm. what kind of technology was in the building? How were we purchasing stuff? What were we doing on recycling? And could we measure it and monitor it and set goals around it? And so that became part of, not separate from, but a part of when we were doing development, when we were thinking about projects, how did we collectively view what did the tenants want? What did we want? What goals were we setting? And so that became kind of dear and important to me as well. You know, what were we doing in the environment? Like, what were the buildings creating? What kind of power were we using? All that kind of stuff. And ironically, Rob, like, you know, my wife who's not here, she was like, you know, quote unquote, interested in what I was doing, but like, you know, not really. And, you know, the stuff around the house she's doing, and I'm sort of paying attention, but, you know, not really. And she's kind of doing the same thing around the house, just different stuff. So, you know, what kind of food are we eating and what kind of soap are we using and what kind of shampoo and, you know, do the deodorant that we're using, what's that made out of? And so it was just kind of a different view of the same lens. That's a bad butchered analog, but you're with me. And so, like, you know, how is it that in our house, the things that we bring into our house, how are they affecting our kids and our dog and us? And so she's thinking about it from a home perspective. I'm thinking about it from a kind of office building and or residential context, multifamily on the built environment. So it was just fascinating to sort of think that through, you know, years later that, you know, we were both kind of on different journeys, but the same kind of thing on what is it that we're bringing into our own space and how can we measure it, monitor it, and do it a little bit better, a bit more efficient, and kind of take responsibility for the things that were coming not only into the house, but into kind of the office buildings where we were working and or the projects that we were building. Make sense?
Absolutely. Well, what I love about what you're just suggesting there is that rather than, you know, green building issues being extraneous to or external to a conventional, you know, real estate transaction process, we completely agree that it needs to be integral with the process. It's no, you know, it's there's too much value and there's too much, you know, there are too many mandates now for including these features, such that, you know, building owners and investors who don't do this are going to be losing out. They're going to be losing value in their properties. I think that's the lesson that a lot of folks are learning these days. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that just to underline that for a second.
Yeah.
That what we believe is not what everybody believes. And so you and I are aligned, which is probably why I'm on your show. But, you know, there's a whole group of folks that aren't there yet. Whether they believe or not that humans create, you know, kind of impact to greenhouse gas, you know, you and I are like, that's a duh thing. But there are a bunch of people that are still kind of thinking about that. But irrespective of that, I mean, that in and of itself is important. You know, it's a whole, we can have a whole conversation on that. But beyond that, when you look at just kind of facts on the ground, and the number of severe weather events that have happened not only in the United States, but around the world in the last 5 years. And it's not so much that there's more events, even though there are, it's the severity of these events.
Exactly right.
And so, you know, we used to have like a $1 billion issue insurance-wise once every blue moon. Well, now there's like 10 billion dollar issues a year. And so whether one believes in climate change or not, which is kind of incontrovertible, but put that aside, these events and kind of physical resilience and what are we doing on, you know, wind and fire? How are we dealing with property and insurance? That's a real thing on the ground. There's right. so much that we can do in the built environment that just makes plain economic sense. You know, we don't need to be tree huggers. We can just be kind of, okay, can we reduce our consumption, which is better for the environment and better for the people around us, and do it in a better way? I mean, so you don't have to be, you know, a granola eating, even though there's nothing wrong with that, you know, person. You can be kind of somebody that's economically driven to reduce consumption and thereby save on, you know, power. You know, those two are not, you know, at opposite sides of the ledger, even though they get pitched that they are.
Exactly right. And what I would add to what you're saying, sort of the other side of this, is that, you know, I've been involved with commercial real estate in New York City for over 20 years, and I understand the mindset. The mindset for, you know, owners and investors and buyers, it's all about value add. That's all you hear, right? Everyone's interested in value add. Okay, fair enough. That's the ground that that's the rules we work with, so to speak. And so when I talk about our, you know, building upgrade, green building upgrade, decarbonization program, I couch it as just the tool you need for your value add strategy as a buyer and investor in today's commercial real estate marketplace. This is just a value add component that you need to have, or you're going to be leaving hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars on the table when you're doing your acquisitions and your upgrades of your building. So this is really smart business is what this is.
I agree with you. I'm just saying that if you went in certain places, not that the South is bad, but if you went in certain places in the South, if you went in certain places in the middle part of the United States, they would debate us on that point. You and I agree. I can show you, you could show folks all day, every day, lighting efficiency upgrades that save you money. Like, why would you not do that? You know, talking about metering and monitoring and measuring. Right. All day, every day. There's just, I'm saying there's a crew of people out there that are not aligned there yet. Hopefully they get there at some point.
Absolutely. Well, especially those publicly traded companies are going to have additional mandates and pressures, if you will, you know, especially in terms of the transformation of the marketplace where there's greater and greater demand for green buildings. But most important is this is this SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, proposed ESG disclosure mandate that would require public companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions and other climate change risks. So what, as far as you know, what's the status of the release of the final program and their requirements?
So if anybody tells you they know exactly what the status is, they'd be BSing you. Right. I talk to folks down the hill often about this topic. And, you know, I have my own view, which makes it my own view and shared by my dog, but nobody else, which I'm happy to share with you guys. But just, you know, take it with a grain of salt. As my wife often says, the fact that I believe it doesn't make it so. And so my view is that the SEC will come out in the next month or so with their final proposed rules. The reason I think that is they came out with the rules. They took, you know, the comment period, and they got the record number of comments, over like 15,650 comments in, you know, on the proposal. And there were some on kind of the side of the ledger that were supportive of it, but were concerned about scope three. There were others that thought that this was complete nonsense and why would we ever do that? Kind of the same people we were just talking about a minute ago. And the SEC then came back and sort of pushed back their rollout of these rules. And they know that they're going to get sued kind of the day after they put them out. You know, but the reason I think that they're going to put them forth kind of at some point in April is because I don't believe that this administration is going to miss the opportunity to have these rules, at least in theory, become effective, even though there's a lawsuit. In the context of they don't think they're going to lose the election, but if God forbid they did, you know, then you're losing another 4 years to get these rules implemented. And so I don't think they're going to take that chance. And so I do think you're going to see those rules in some form or fashion come out in April. Kind of the scuttlebutt is, you know, how much is scope three going to be watered down? And so, again, your viewers, listeners, understand what scope one, two, and three is. But on scope three, the question is, you know, does everybody have to report that? Do you have to be a big filer to report that? You know, is it material to you? And what does that mean? So there's a whole lot in kind of what I just said. And, you know, without scope three, it will be a watered down version of what it otherwise could be. But it will still be a very important piece of legislation. I mean, you know, the punchline is that because it's taken them so long, California's kind of jumped ahead of them and has passed what is tantamount to kind of the SEC's rules already. And so at the end of last year, as you guys are likely aware, you know, California passed like three very important bills. You know, one was effective now, 2024, that said, hey, you know, companies, you need to report on your risk disclosures from climate change. So do you believe, and what do you believe relative to physical risk and other risks you have, and you need to file a report. So that's effective now. Then they have two other bills that trigger off of, you know, are you making over $500 million or over $1 billion? You know, query, you know, at the end of the day, the rules will be like, how's that look? Is that doing business in California or like physically, or is it touching California and you have those numbers? But those two bills do the same thing that the SEC rules will. They require disclosure of climate-related numerics. And if you have goals, those goals need to be verified, measured, and monitored by a third party. They talk about, again, whether you're public or not public. If you have those numbers, 500 million or a billion, you must disclose scope one, two, and three. Now, again, Rob, you know, the interesting thing about the SEC's rules, and in particular about California's rules, are it's, yes, the SEC's rules hit on public companies. California's rules hit on public and private, but it's not just the public companies in the SEC context. It's not just the companies in California at the $500 and the billion-dollar level. Why do I say that? Because anybody in those companies' supply chain that's feeding them product or packaging or raw materials, those companies will be the scope three emitters for the companies that have to report. Right. And so whether you're public or private, if you're in their supply chain, those companies are going to raise their hand and say, and they already have in California, hey, I need this disclosure. In order for me to make my disclosure obligations, I need it from you, Mr. or Ms. Supplier. And by the way, we love you. We've been working with you for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. if you can't provide us with that information, we can't do business with you, because right. you're going to impact our ability to comply.
Right.
And so that's a powerful, powerful thing. Because it's not just the public companies that have to report, it's anybody that's touching them is going to need to feed them info. And that's what I think people are not sensing or seeing yet. There's going to be a tsunami of reporting disclosure obligations on folks that are not even in the same, you know, church, ballpark, whatever analogy you want to use, as we are relative to this. And they're going to be asked all these questions that they're not going to know the answers to, which is why they're going to be calling you to help them.
Which is just going to be more of the pressures and the market transformation that's going to be, that's going to be something that, you know, commercial real estate owners, along with everything else they're dealing with, they're going to have to be addressing this. And it's not an easy time to be the owner of commercial real estate. I mean, I will acknowledge that it's a lot of pressure.
Not for the faint of heart, my friend.
Not at all. From your perspective as a practicing real estate attorney, because principally that's what you do, what is your view on this proposed mandate? Do you see it as reasonable and as needed by society? What is your general view on it?
All right, I'm going to give you my SEC disclosure, my own personal one. So these are my views. They do not represent that of the firm or anybody else. They are just my views.
That's right.
And by the way, just as an aside, if people are interested in the California bills, it's SB 253 and SB 261, I believe. So 253 and 261.
Right.
So what's my personal view of the SEC's rules to require climate disclosure? Well, my view is that as an investor, so what's the SEC supposed to be doing? They're supposed to be guarding, the gates, on behalf of Sally Q and John Q Public, who are investors in public companies, to get information so that they can make informed decisions.
Right.
Information to make informed decisions. And so can one make an informed decision without this type of data? Well, we've been doing it, since time immemorial. So why is this different? Well, some would say, not all, but some would say, you're making decisions without a full deck of cards. You don't have all the information in front of you in order to make that informed decision. It's not the only thing you should be looking at, but isn't it relevant if the building's going to be underwater in 5 years or 10 years or 100 years? Isn't it relevant that the cost of power in a particular place is going to go up threefold? Isn't it relevant that insurance in some places, you can't get insurance? Not that it's going to be expensive. You can't get it. And so, I think it's a little bit myopic, but I get it. It's political, where some states, 14 of them have said, hey, if you are money managers, look at any of these ESG factors, we are not going to use you ever again. That's what they've passed these rules. Well, to me, I'm like, I don't get that. Meaning, I want my money manager to look at all kinds of information. I'm not saying the only thing they should look at is ESG, but I want them to have that as part of the things that they look at in making a decision or suggesting something to me. And so it doesn't concern me that one would have to make that disclosure. Again, I'm not the one disclosing, but if I was, it wouldn't bother me. Sure, it will cost money to do that. Yes, they were estimating somewhere between $500,000 to $1 million for public companies to put the systems in place in order to measure, monitor, and then have a third party verify. So that's expensive, which I totally appreciate. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that their investors, more and more, whether you've got a foreign investor that's been looking at this type of data for 5 and 7 years over in the EU and Australia and Canada. Mm-hmm. So if those investors are investing in U.S. companies, they're going to demand that. They already have. That's where some of this pressure is coming from. If it's our kids who are investing, they're all over this. Not every kid, but many. And if it's, kind of many people are interested in these types of attributes. Again, not 100% all ESG every day, but they want to know that part of the decision that was being made included what's going to happen, from a resiliency perspective, what's going to happen from a climate change perspective, what's going to happen from an insurance perspective, how are we dealing with, ESG and in the S bucket, some
folks are very interested in, does your company adhere to certain diversity, equity, and inclusion goals? Are you meeting them? What are you doing to include people of color and LGBTQ folks in your decision-making and your employment? And so again, the more people that that is relevant to as time goes on, the more people will continue to ask. And the SEC is the one at this point, after California, pushing for this information that, you know, disclose it. Then it's up to the investor to make the decision on whether it's important to them or not, or whether they like what they see. But the SEC is saying, disclose it so that people can make a more informed decision. So I have no problem with that. And I think it's frankly the right thing to be doing.
So what I find sort of odd, for lack of a better word, as somebody who has done commercial brokerage along with all, you know, development and construction consulting. So in real estate brokerage, there is a fundamental and widely accepted principle of disclosure. Mm-hmm. You know, disclosure is not something that's somehow
bad
to real estate. It's inherent to every real estate transaction, if especially, you know, in residential. If you know that you've got asbestos or lead paint or mold in your house, you have to disclose that, and failure to disclose that can open you up to significant liability. That's essentially what this is. And, you know, so I, you know, there's really, again, from a professional real estate brokerage perspective, you know, this is par for the course. Nothing new here, except that it's newly being applied to commercial real estate for carbon emissions.
Well, and it's new in the sense, Rob, that what's being measured hasn't been measured before. So it's not that it's a lack of telling anything. It's right. That they never measured this before. So we're saying, hey, this is important to somebody, the constituents, the consumers, and therefore one should measure it. It's like saying, you know, to your equivalent, you know, look, you got to test for radon. If you haven't tested for radon, you got to test and you got to tell the buyer, you know, is it 4 picocuries or more? Well, the SEC is sort of saying, well, look, we want to know water, waste, energy, what's going on here? And we want to know scope 1, what are you using? Mm-hmm. Scope 2, how much is your utility emitting? And scope 3, what's your supply chain emitting? So that people have like a rules for the road that they can measure one company's impact versus another. Mm-hmm. Again, you and I are aligned. I'd rather have more information and decide what I want to make a decision based on than not being given the information at all. And so that to me is what's odd. People typically want information rather than saying, oh, no, you can't even look at that information in managing my money. That's just a little bit strange, to say the least.
I'll tell you, it's almost otherworldly to see to see people fighting with BlackRock. You know, well, BlackRock, that's all over this.
Yes, they have been, and they will continue to be. They are a leader in this space. But even they, trillions of dollars, I mean, they are beyond big. Even they have reacted to, you know, a bunch of these states saying, doing what we were talking about, meaning that they will not. And, you know, they were kicked off of an account, I think, in Texas, maybe Oklahoma, because right. In those states, they passed these anti-ESG for purposes of running our state money. And we're talking about, you know, billions of dollars of teachers, fire people, you know, police, you know, there's a lot of money there. And so, you know, even with BlackRock, who is a bastion of leadership in this space, and I think was like the first one out there to sort of take a public position, you've even seen them in 24, late 23, they're dialing back the ESG rhetoric, you know, put aside whether, you know, we need them to say ESG. You know, you're seeing a lot of the larger money managers soft pedal ESG in terms of changing the vocabulary back to maybe sustainability, back to resiliency, back to asset value, away from ESG, which has become politically charged.
Yes.
You know, because they just don't want to have to have, it's noise, they don't want to have to fight that fight, and they want to continue to be able to do what they're doing.
Right.
So, you know, there's a little bit of that going on.
Well, and I do believe that, and I get this point, that I do believe that within, you know, environmental social governance, it's the social part that I think is the most, that's the biggest hot hot, you know, issue.
Yeah, people are reacting to that. That's like your anti-woke folks.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. Yeah. And whereas on the E side, I think there's growing acceptance. And I have to tell you, from my perspective, you know, the older I get, the more, you know, what's really, really important to me fundamentally is this whole notion of externalized costs, right?
Yes.
So this notion that, you know, you can just exhaust carbon emissions into the atmosphere and it's free. There's no cost. There's no cost to doing that. Well, it turns out that there's a huge cost to we taxpayers, as you said earlier, to be paying for the great growing costs on an annual basis for all these extreme storms. And, you know, and again, those of us who know about climate change, I like to refer to it as climate crisis. We're not saying that, you know, that this climate crisis is creating these storms. We're saying it's intensifying these storms, right? And there is a cost. It is not free. So with the ESG mandate, what I see it doing eventually is to be requiring an ESG score on commercial buildings. And it's my understanding that a low ESG score is going to act like a low FICO score. So a building will be worth less money. You'll be held, you know, so building owners who have this attitude that they could just be dumping for free their carbon emissions, they're going to start to be, their costs are going to start to be internalized, and it's going to start to impact on the value of their real estate. And I think that's a really important thing.
Yeah, look, I think you're correct. It is an important thing. And so we've got kind of, you know, 48, 49 states that, you know, 7-10 years ago started to require building benchmarking. So what are you doing by way of water, waste, and energy? And a required kind of reporting regime. So that was where it started. Then it evolved a little bit to, well, some places require commissioning. You know, every 5 years you had to go and look at what you had done in the building and how it was performing versus what it should have been. And so there were a variety of cities that passed commissioning requirements. Now we've got kind of building performance standard, BPS, which is, okay, we're going to look at not only what you're doing, but if you don't meet a certain standard by way of greenhouse gas emissions, we're going to fine you. Because we, these cities, believe that this is important enough that we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which tie into scope 1, 2, and 3. That's how we kind of measure greenhouse gas or GHG. And so, you know, cities like Boston and Cambridge and New York and Montgomery County, Maryland and DC and St. Louis and Denver, Seattle, they have requirements now that if you need to report and if you report and you're above a certain level, you get fined. That's kind of the highest level down to, you know, you have some time to remediate. And so Local Law 97, which was New York's, you know, flavor on that, which was first out into the marketplace, you know, that's in effect now. They're giving people time to comply. So it's not like they wanted to raise all these fines. That's not what they're, at least that's what they're saying. That's not what they're into. What they're into is fixing the issue. So they're giving people time past 2024 to comply. But that rule is in effect now. It's in effect now in Boston. It's in effect now in DC and the places that I talked about before. And so to your point, Rob, if you're an owner in those places, you better be paying attention. Again, it's not a value judgment at this point. It's going to cost you money if you don't pay attention. You need to deal with your leases and who's creating the greenhouse gas, the tenants, and make sure that, you know, you've got the right dynamic in the lease that will allow for the landlord to pass through a fine if the tenant creates kind of the greenhouse gas impact, and the ability to create the right measurement system, have the right consultants to be able to verify that what you're measuring is correct and that your fuel mix is accurately reported. But in those places, which are the start, you know, you look at the map that there's a group called the Institute for Market Transformation, IMT. If you go to imt.org, they've got great maps that show all these places where benchmarking started. So you kind of look at the United States. It used to be the smile kind of from Portland, Maine slash Boston all the way down and then back up around. And the middle was missing. Well, over the last 5 years, the middle has now caught up. And so there's many, many cities over 50 that require benchmarking. You have to report on water, waste, and energy. Again, that's the start. There's a different map that shows you these building performance standards. This, the greenhouse gas impact, kind of the local law 97, the BEEPS in Boston. And that map is smaller, but again, it's growing. You know, the places that have benchmarking, big surprise, are the places that have BEPS. So like the state of Washington, the state of Oregon, the state of Colorado, those three states, the state of Maryland,
have benchmarking. They also have, you know, kind of these reporting obligations. And so you can just look at those two maps, you know, side by side and see where things are a-coming. And if you're in those states and you're not paying attention, or if you're in those cities in various states, you need to be paying attention, even if you're
kind of in a state that's against this stuff. So when I, you know, you sort of look at, well, where is the hotbed of anti? Well, this is Florida. Well, Miami and Orlando have already signed on to benchmarking rules. If you are in Orlando, Miami, you must do that. Texas, again, anti this stuff. Austin requires you to do it.
Right.
Georgia, Atlanta requires you to do it. So again, even in places where the state has taken anti positions, there are cities within those states that have said, look, we hear you, but we think it's important. And so we're going to require, if you're doing business in this place, you must report. And that's kind of the first step towards, not only are you going to report, but then we're going to decide whether on the greenhouse gas side, we're emitting too much. Why? Because buildings emit a lot of GHG. Probably 40% of the greenhouse gas effect is coming from buildings, office, school, residential. And so that's why buildings are very important. If we can sort of address the buildings and reduce emissions in those buildings, we will take a good step towards emissions reductions.
Yeah. Brad, we're running out of time, but just such a pleasure.
To be
talking about this subject with you. And that concludes another inspiring episode of Green to Gold, our Green to Gold podcast. We hope you enjoyed the deep dive into how building decarbonization mandates can be turned into profitable value add opportunities. A huge thank you to our fantastic guest, Brad Malofsky, for sharing his expertise and shedding light on the transformation of commercial building marketplace with growing low carbon mandates and the value of building decarbonization. Brad, what's the best way for folks to get in touch with you if they want to work with you?
So that's a good question. Email is probably the best way to find me. You're welcome to use my cell phone, but I'm not a great person with voicemail. So if you're welcome to call my cell, 609-280-7483, 609-280-7483. If you get voicemail, don't leave a voicemail. Just text me. Hey, I was on Rob's thing. I heard your name. Love to talk, and give me your name. Right. Because if somebody calls me without a name, I don't pick that up either. So, you know, give me the name that way, or email at my work email is fine. bamolotsky@dwaynemars.com. So it's bamolotsky at Dwayne, D-U-A-N-E, Morris, MORRIS.com. Feel free to drop an email blind. You just mentioned Rob's, show, so that I know what the context is. And I'm always happy to get back to people and chit chat about this stuff, you know, till the cows come home.
Fantastic. So we also want to thank our listeners. Please do subscribe to our Green to Gold podcast and leave a review. And again, Brad, a big thank you very much. And
a total pleasure.
I hope to speak with you soon. Take care.
Yeah. Keep up the great work, Rob.
A pleasure. Always happy to come on and chat sustainability or whatever else you're focusing on at that moment. And we'll hopefully go make some magic together.
Sounds like a plan. Thank you.
All right. Super. Have a great weekend.
You too.